Welcome to the September 10th policy planning meeting of the La Crosse County Board of Supervisors. We have a quorum present with 27 members. I will call us to order and ask that those who choose to join me stand and recite the Pledge of Allegiance. Be sure to ask a supervisor who's been around more than a dozen years or so what that reference was on the ringing cell phone. Welcome, everyone. We will start with supervisor conference reports and announcements. Are there any supervisor fairies?
I have one announcement. If you notice on your desk, I hope I caught everybody. Two of our retired county board supervisors would like to express their thank you for everything that the county board does. It's Jerry and Arlene, and if you read that memo in front of you there, and everybody's invited. And as you note that, it is mandatory that you're there, you know, so there's no excuses. So that's the 20th, next Thursday. And I'll remind you then, too. Thank you.
Thank you, Supervisor Ferry. Supervisor Doyle.
I want to follow up on what he said and really encourage people to attend. You know, Arlene and Jerry had been on the board for many, many years. They did so much for the board. They took care of our picnic every year. And I know both of them, because I see them on a fairly regular basis, always say how much they miss the people that they used to be with on the county board here. And I think they've earned us spending a night drinking their beer and pop. And I would really encourage people to show up. They're good people, and I'm going to be there. I mean, that's not why you have to go, but I will be there, and I hope you will also.
On the computer, we'll be voting on whether or not we want Supervisor Doyle to be there. No, just joking. Other supervisor conference report, Supervisor Geary.
No, not a report. On the WCA convention, do we have a booth that we're supposed to sign up for some times to work it, or what do we? I didn't get any information on that.
Terry Pavlik and Mary Nagley are helping to coordinate that along with the county clerk, and I think they're planning on communicating with people through email to ask for help where they need it. I think we have the other shifts for the tours and other things that we need additional help with. And there will be more details on the agenda for next Thursday's meeting. Thank you for the reminder. Supervisor Schrader.
I talked to Marion today, and she's doing nothing about it, so.
I'm hoping by the 20th, the meeting on the 20th next Thursday, that will change.
And I also think that Steve Doyle is going to bring apples.
Another inside joke for those who've been here longer than a couple years. You'll need to talk to the aforementioned supervisors to get the laugh on that one. So I see we're setting the stage for a humorous night tonight. I appreciate that very much. Any other jokes or commentary from the peanut gallery? If not, we'll move to the administrator's report. Mr. O'Malley.
Okay, this will be pretty dry. You have on your desk the updated calendar of meetings. Just to highlight a couple of things, I apologize today. We canceled and rescheduled the Veterans Aging and Long-Term Care Committee. We got to every one of the committee members, but we forgot to realize that a number of you like to come to other committees that you are not a part of, and so at least one or two of you came to that meeting, and it did not happen this morning. So I want to walk through what the changes are. Thursday's meeting for the Legislative Committee has been canceled and will be rescheduled in October. Our three legislators have other commitments and aren't able to attend. The Executive Committee meeting for this week and Aging and Long-Term Care will be combined to Monday the 17th. And here's the exact sequence. At 8 o'clock, Exec will meet separately. They have a couple of small agenda items to deal with. Then at 8:30 will be a joint meeting of the two committees, which will deal primarily with and only with the Lakeview consultant for the strategic plan and the site consultant for the Lakeview plan. So that's the purpose of that meeting, of the joint meeting together of exec and aging and long-term care. And then at 9:30, aging and long-term care, again, will have a short meeting. We thought it was easier to combine all of that to get two committees to weigh in on that. The recommendation for the consultant then, both the site consultant and the strategic plan, will come to the full county board next Thursday. So that will be in your agenda packet, and we'll give you the best information we can.
Mr. O'Malley, will you just clarify why we had to push it to the 17th instead of doing it this week, please?
In order to be able to meet the calendar of issuing the RFP after your input last month on directing us to go ahead with that, get enough time for the consultants to actually respond and be able to have enough time to do a review and interview and then bring a recommendation back. This is the only way we could do it. Otherwise, the decision would have been pushed to October, which would put us too far behind any kind of timeline for us to be able to get that information. So let me just pause and see if there are any questions about the changes in committee meetings for this month. And again, we checked with Executive Committee and Aging and Long-Term Care. There are very few other agenda items, so it seemed to work out better than to have you meet for a short time this week, a short time on Wednesday, and then for a joint meeting. I had mentioned this at the last monthly meeting as well, that we would probably need a special meeting, and so that's what actually worked out. Another item then that's also on your desk, and unless there are any questions about meeting schedule, are the United Way campaign forms. We're doing a big push on that with employees and encouraging everyone to participate, even if it's a small dollar amount. The United Way, as you know, fits a unique niche in our community and actually helps reduce the demand for county services, particularly in health and human services and throughout the community. So please, if you're able to, I know a lot of our employees participate and encourage supervisors to as well. So there's information on your desk with that. You can submit that for automatic payroll deduction. It makes it very simple, and many of us, including leadership, also participate at quite a significant level. The last item that I have, because I think that's every item that's on your desk other than handouts related to the presentations, Madam Chair, is the proclamation, September 2012, Libraries and UW Extension Month. Whereas research-based educational programs for agricultural producers, professionals, businesses, local governments, communities, families, and youth are brought to the residents of La Crosse County. And whereas research-based educational and library programs identify and respond to specific community needs for education, research, and knowledge to improve the quality of life in local communities, to strengthen families, to increase the competitiveness of businesses and agriculture, enhance decision-making in local government, and to develop leadership skills for managing resources and planning for the future. And whereas libraries provide recreational and educational resources for residents in pursuit of lifelong learning, and whereas UW Extension programming combines faculty, campus-based specialists, and staff expertise to bring university research to the people of La Crosse County in the areas of agricultural horticulture, community natural resources and economic development, family living, education, 4-H, and youth development, and whereas UW Extension faculty and staff and area library staff are committed to educating the residents of La Crosse County in order to promote lifelong learning and provide a more knowledgeable and informed community, now therefore be it resolved that La Crosse County Board does hereby proclaim the month of September as La Crosse County Libraries and UW Extension Month and urges all residents to join in recognizing the valuable contribution of persons dedicated to educating the residents and engaging with them in transforming lives and communities in La Crosse County.
Is there a motion to approve the proclamation? Moved by Supervisor Ferries, seconded by Supervisor Holtz. Discussion on the proclamation. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. That proclamation is approved.
Madam Chair, we have a number of items to provide a report on. I'll just check with the county clerk. Were we able to get the video working for the first one? Okay. So it looks like, Lee, we're not going to be able to do the YouTube video, so we'll have to work without all of the benefits of the... With no further ado, let me introduce President Lee Rosch with Western Technical College. I believe most of you know him. He'll be presenting on Vision 2020.
We apologize for the technical difficulties, but YouTube is blocked in the county internet system, so our apologies.
Probably for good reason. Thank you. Well, thank all of you, and
I'm really delighted to have this opportunity to talk about our Vision 2020 plan. And to put this in perspective, Vision 2020 is a comprehensive strategic plan that was approved by our district board in June of 2010. The activities that go into this plan are significant from our perspective because we think they're designed to have a significant impact on our results, and they go beyond facilities. They're involving significant changes in curriculum, changes in the way we staff and schedule programs and coursework, and then trying to align the facilities so that we can bring these things together. It's kind of like a three-legged stool. And if we do that, we believe we'll have a significant impact on serving more people in our community. This is a map of the district for Western Technical College. And as you can see, it's a large area. It's about 5,000 square miles. And many people are surprised to learn that 52% of our students live outside of La Crosse County. In fact, if you look at the distribution by population or by tax support or enrollment, it's very, very close to an identical alignment. And so you can see that what we're bringing forward is something that would have a regional impact. And if we're going to ask our voters in the entire district to support that, it's important that we also deliver on increased enrollment that would have an impact district-wide as well. This graph here shows the percentages of high school students that come to Western. The blue bars represent high school transfers the year immediately following high school graduation, and the red bars are students that come to us within 3 years. And you can see that we have a significant percentage. Look at the three-year percentages for La Crosse County. For example, in terms of individual districts in our area, 31% of the Holman students will come to Western within 3 years. In Onalaska, it's 34%. In West Salem, it's 36%. La Crosse Central, 37%. Bangor, 40%. Logan, 43%. Clearly, Western is the college of choice for a significant percentage of the population in our area. And we feel good that we're producing things that would be providing good results for this community, because when we track how our students are doing, 93% report that they're working within 6 months of graduation, and 81% of those graduates are going to be living here in this region. So you have a significant return on that investment. I think this slide, to me, is the one that has the greatest import. As I said, we do a six-month follow-up survey, and we want to find out if our graduates are satisfied with Western. Are they working? Are they working related to their training? How much are they earning? And as I said, 93% report that they're working within 6 months of graduation, and the wages that they report 6 months after graduation is at about what the state median wage is at that time. Now, we survey that same group 5 years later. This shows you what the five-year follow-up survey showed, and that same group of students is now, 5 years later, earning 58% more. Now think about that. How many jobs do you know can offer the equivalent of a 58% pay raise, or 9.5% per year compounded for five straight years? So what do you think is happening? Beyond just getting a job, they're getting promotions, they're getting better paying positions, they're continuing their education, they're building their futures. This is a very significant indication of what that payback is to the area. And it's not just a short-term immediate gain. It's a significant one long-term. It's also interesting to note, we compare how we're doing with the rest of the state, and actually the wage increase over the last five-year period is better here than it was for the rest of the state. And this is interesting, too. You know, I've been at Western since 1989, and I've been tracking how our region does in terms of the key economic indicators compared to the eastern two-thirds of the state. And I can say that for decades, we lagged the eastern two-thirds of the state in wages, in property valuation increases, in unemployment statistics, and so on. About 6 or 7 years ago, that flipped, and it's holding there. In fact, we got the most recent property valuation figures, and they were broken down by technical college district. I like this because our district reflects the Seven Rivers region on the Wisconsin side, and we were the only district that had an increase. Now think about that. The other districts, Madison, that's Thrive. The other districts, Fox Valley and Northeast, that's New North. Many times we can get a sense that the things that we do, they don't make a difference. They don't have an impact. And the answer is they do. Now, Western is not going to take credit for the regional economic changes, but I can assure you this, that we're committed to do everything in our power to contribute to that. So I talked about some of the things that go into Vision 2020, and I'd like to highlight what is involved with the curriculum and scheduling activities. For example, beginning fall 2013, we're going to operate a year-round calendar. We're running a summer trimester, which will allow us to do several things that we can't do so well right now. For example, some students can come to us and they can get an associate degree in 18 months. Others, particularly in the health occupations where they're competing for clinical experiences required by their programs, and they're competing against Viterbo and UWL and Winona State in the healthcare facilities, those students can now take clinical experiences in the summer, which is going to allow us to increase our capacity without increasing our staffing support. It's going to give us an opportunity to spread out what we're doing in terms of our overall scheduling. Another key initiative beginning fall of 2013 is something we're calling Western Express. This is an evening, weekend, blended online initiative that's designed to reach more working adults in our community. Many people are surprised to hear this statistic. If you look at the poverty statistics in the city of La Crosse, 25.3% of the adults aged 18 to 64 are living below the poverty level. Now, students at the university, if they're living in a residence hall, are not counted in that. Students that are living in rentals in the community are. So you could say, let's take that percentage down several percentage points. It's still a huge number. And La Crosse County's unemployment rate is second only to Dane County in Wisconsin. I mean, it's not great, but what it says is that there are a lot of people in our community that are working, but they're not making a livable wage. And they're least likely to be able to quit their job to go to school full time. They're probably a high percentage single parents. So the idea of putting out more evening, weekend, online blended is trying to reach that population to try to give them access to education that could benefit them the most. And I believe, if you look at the data in terms of the graduate follow-up, benefit the region the most. Some of the other things we're doing in terms of curriculum are breaking down our traditional programs into certificates at the entry level and advanced certificates. The entry level certificates are going to give people a chance to come in and take 4 to 5, maybe 6 courses in a certificate and get enough skills to be job ready in certain key areas. This is a key thing for someone who's been out of school, an adult who may lack confidence in their ability to be successful and may not be able to afford a full degree program, and there are jobs available for CNC operators and welders and people in information technology if you can get that kind of certification. But if those credits transfer into our traditional degree programs or into other college and university programs, those individuals also have a start on a pathway that could continue. Because obviously, if we're looking at, we're shooting for 2020 as our goal, but if we're looking at the job market today, things are much more dynamic and fluid, and we need to give people transportable credentials wherever possible. The other area of advanced certificates is to allow us to do more training as a continuing education and more training that would be in partnership with area businesses so that we can provide additional skills without waiting for a degree. So all of these changes could give us an opportunity to significantly impact what we're doing. And I will say that even though we're not projecting state funding to increase, at Western in 2001, we received about $12 million a year. In 2012, it's about $5 million a year. and our operating property tax levy is fixed by state law. But I will say that even with those elements in place, we're projecting by 2020 that we're going to serve 1,000 more people, full-time equivalent. Right now we serve about 4,000 full-time equivalent. In 2020, that'll be 5,000. So this is why this is such an important issue for us. And it's possible if we do all of these things together. It's like a three-legged stool. We have to do the curricular change. We have to do the efficiency and scheduling. And we're asking the community to help us by aligning our facilities. So it is a large issue that we're bringing forward. But if we do those things, we think the impact is going to be significant district-wide. So what are the things that we're bringing forward in the plan? Well, the first project is to redo the Coleman Building. Next year, the Coleman Building will be 90. And the boilers and other infrastructure elements are, for the most part, original. It's a facility that's been remodeled and added on and redone a number of times over the years. At one time, it was the only auditorium in the city. It wasn't UWL at that time. It was La Crosse State Teachers College had their commencement ceremony over here in the Coleman Auditorium because that was the largest facility available at that time. This building can be redone into a state-of-the-art classroom building. It would cost $26.5 million to do it. A new building of this size, 151,000 square feet, would cost more in the neighborhood of about $35 million. The second facility is to redo the CUM Center to give us much more capacity for science, science-related lab coursework for students that start at Western and transfer, and for students going into the health occupations. And this is going to allow us to do more biology, chemistry, physics, and simulation in these labs so that we can increase the capacity in these high-demand areas. The third project is, I think, the flagship effort. This is to take the two-story Applied Technology Building that's located on 7th Street across from the Lunda Center. And the building has a foundation that will allow it to go up to four stories. And so we're going to gut the building and build a four-story integrated technology center, a building that will allow all of the manufacturing programs and all of the building systems programs to be co-located and to integrate the curriculum using certificates like I talked about and aligning our curriculum so that like programs can have required capstone courses which will replicate the work in industry and significantly increase capacity in an area of high demand. It's also an area where colleges around the country that have developed these kinds of facilities have developed successful partnerships with area businesses that are willing to locate high-cost equipment, high-cost technology equipment, and allow colleges to use it for training. And they would bring it in and use it for demonstration purposes for customers or whatever. But when the new technology comes in, they're willing to take that technology out and put in upgraded equipment. It's a huge asset that we need to be reaching here. And this is not a statement against Train Company. Train Company is a partner in an advanced technology center, but they're a partner with the Gateway District in Racine because they have this kind of arrangement there. And we're not a partner here because we don't have our programs aligned in this way. And there are other companies that are willing to do this as well. And so it's a significant aspect. These are the other three projects. We have a diesel program in the industrial park. It's a program that's currently overcrowded. We're leasing space in the old Gateway Foods distribution facility. This will allow us to combine those spaces in under a single roof, but it'll also allow us to do some curricular things with certificates, such as compressed natural gas. As you know, Quick Trip is converting their fleet to CNG, and other organizations are scheduled to follow, and we're not offering CNG training. And it's not likely there's going to be a degree in CNG, but there will be a need for advanced training at the certificate level. So we can respond to that with this facility change. The second project on this list is a greenhouse and horticulture landscape lab. We have an existing landscape horticulture program that uses leased space in the community. and we wanted to bring it on the campus here. Meanwhile, we have been approached by a community organization, the Hillview Urban Agriculture Center, and they want to locate their greenhouse on our campus. Now, they have the old greenhouse is up there near the Eco Park and near the university, if you're familiar with that, and it's an old greenhouse. It's not very efficient. They indicated that it's costing them in the winter $20 a pound to grow tomatoes, and it wasn't really doing what it should do as a community service. They have two generous donors that are pledging $220,000 to help with the co-location. And so we're going to allow them to have apply that money to the college to reduce rent so they could be located next to our program. In the meantime, there are five city lots, and we're planning to build replacement housing, which we'll then sell. But we currently do replacement housing throughout the county now, but we're planning to build passive-rated energy-efficient housing. Passive is the highest rating for residential housing, highest energy efficiency. A senior official at Organic Valley in Viroqua has built a passive-rated home, and she claims that she can heat it with a hairdryer. Well, the key here is that we have the technology and the expertise in our programs to build replacement housing, and now we have a whole new level that we're able to bring in. And hopefully, we'll see more replacement housing all throughout the region that could be using this this kind of technology once we have it here. Finally, even though we're going to have more evening and more summer programming, we realize we need to address the parking needs if we're going to seek to have 1,000 more people enrolled. So this is the issue that we're bringing to the voters. Oh, by the way, this is what it would look like on our campus. The greenhouse would be in the site where our old residence hall was, the Campus Inn, the Ivy Motel. You can see the Integrated Technology Center would be on the Applied Center Technology Center space, and the parking ramp would be on the cross street. So this is what we're bringing forward. It's a $79.8 million referendum, but because it's covering the entire district, the tax levy impact would be on a $100,000 piece of property. It would be about $39 a year. And we're bringing it forward to the voters on November 6th. And we know this is a high turnout election, and we're doing that intentionally. In fact, I heard on public radio they're projecting a 70% turnout. And we're doing this intentionally because we're getting out to try to help explain the total plan to our community. And we're asking them to study all of the issues and, as informed citizens, weigh in on Western's Vision 2020. So why is this a good time? Well, I talked about the ability to build regional business partnerships, and that will do things that will help us to grow the regional economy if we can provide more training at this level. Interest rates are at an historic low, and this same project would be much more expensive if we were even at the traditional interest rates. The project itself, in the construction phase, will create over 300 construction-related jobs and generate $112 million. And this is according to North Star Economics, who has provided this economic impact analysis for us. But I think by far the most significant thing is that we feel we have a chance to put 1,000 more people into what I call the 58% pathway. A chance to get more people into those kinds of jobs that are providing that kind of impact to them in their lives and to our community. So this is what we're bringing forward. I'll stop here and entertain any questions or any comments.
Supervisor Holtz.
Yeah, you're saying $39 a year. Is that for the 20 years that's projected up there?
Yes, I should explain. It is bonding for 20 years.
Other questions? I know everybody wanted to see the YouTube video. We're sorry that we couldn't see that. But Supervisor Landry.
Thank you. I had a question about one of your first comments about the reduced monies you've got from the state. And the effect that that may have had on having to go to this referendum. And I'm not a math whiz by any stretch, but it sounds like the reduction in state aid that you've got is around $70 million since 2001. And that sounds about roughly the same amount that you're asking for this project. Is there a cause and effect relationship there? Would you not have went to a referendum if the funding levels would have stayed the same?
There are two different pots of funds. And the funds that have been cut from the state go into our operating fund, and that allows us to do more scheduling and increase our capacity. Unfortunately, we have people on waiting lists right now that we would like to be able to serve. These are dollars to help in our facility investment. But what we're doing is we're recognizing that if we do the three things together, we can gain efficiency and we can control our destiny. We can't wait for the federal government, the state government, or the economy to provide answers to these things. We've been on this journey for about 10 years now where it's progressively being cut back. And so this is our proposal to take some of these things in our own hands and do the best we can.
Supervisor Ferries.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Has there ever been any consideration to, with the parking ramp, to build above that with dormitories or the facilities for the schools?
It's a possibility. We have, due to state law change, we have the possibility to build a residence hall that could be funded on the basis of fees, the monthly fees that students pay, and if we bond with revenue bonds, then we could retire that. There is not an end plan, a plan to build a second residence hall. But putting the parking structure in place would do two things. It would give us the capacity with parking to do that if we decided to, if the college decided to, at some time in the future. So it will help us. The structure itself, though, if we go up, it probably would be with more parking going up.
Supervisor Paff.
Thank you. I just wondering, if the referendum doesn't pass, do you have an alternate route, or how would you deal with that?
You saw the size of the district, and it's just not something that Western can do to go out to the voters again and again and again. It's not something that just makes sense for us to do. And as I said, it's like a three-legged stool, and if one of the legs is shorter, then we're going to have to figure out what we can do, and we're probably not going to achieve the goals that we set, at least not to the extent that we have. But you can be assured we're not going to fold up our tent, and we're going to do what we can given the dynamics that we have. That's why the challenge is really for us to get out throughout the entire district and get to an opportunity to speak to as many people as we can, because this we really kind of feel is the best one and only opportunity to bring this forward.
Supervisor Ebert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, there's been some rumblings around here the past few years about a parking ramp to between the county, the city, and the tech school. Is this part of that, or is this an independent, or what?
This would be independent of that. And that's why when I said what would happen if we needed more parking, I would say then we'd have to figure out how to do that, but it would be, and this would be the site that could go up to give more parking. But we also were very interested in exploring that, but we need to make these initiatives forward now if we're going to have a capacity that we're looking to serve.
Thank you very much, sir.
Other questions from supervisors? Supervisor Geary.
Yeah, you were mentioning something earlier about the healthcare field. Do you ever use facilities at UWL, St. Francis, Gunderson? If they've got facilities like that aren't being used for certain time blocks, do you send an instructor over there with the students to use it, or do they come to your facility?
Well, the areas of demand for health are in two areas: the clinical experiences, and that's where a medical person from the healthcare facilities is supervising our students. And there are a limited number of clinical sites that are available that offer the array of experiences, and so we have a bottleneck. Turbo, UWL, Winona State. We're all trying to get at the same site. So we believe that by going with a summer schedule, we can free that up without increasing any staffing and so on. But the second area has to do with more science labs, biology, chemistry, simulation labs. These are the things that are going to give more students a chance to get exposed to these fields. We did a survey with the Health Science Consortium, and they surveyed the entire region, and they wanted to find out how many people are planning to retire from healthcare occupations within the next, at this time it was 3 years ago. It was about 3 years ago. When the economic downturn hit, a lot of people obviously said, we can't afford to retire, and they held back. But there were, in that survey, 5,000 people 3 years ago who were between the ages of 55 and 65 working in the healthcare community. And just the demographics of that group going through, they're going to be leaving and retiring. And so we have a real challenge in our country and in our region to try to find ways to bring in the replacement people, and we're not going to have the added operating revenue to do that. So we're going to have to do some things with trying to get younger people into these fields, probably do things while students are in high school to give them preparatory courses in science and allow those courses to transfer. It's a different way we're going to increase our capacity, but we're just going to have to do some things different because we won't have the ability to, in a traditional way, to increase our enrollment. Those are high-cost programs.
That wasn't exactly my question, but do you use UWL facilities for any classes?
We share spaces at the Health Science Center.
But I mean for different fields, if they've got the facilities and they're not being used during certain days or time blocks, have you contacted them, or do they ever use your facilities for anything?
The Health Science Center is where we got together to agree to share spaces on that. In our traditional programs, we don't do that.
Other questions from supervisors? Supervisor Karen Johnson.
Mm-hmm. Am I correct when I'm looking at, I found a chart on your website about this, that the tax comes from the region where students are, not just La Crosse County?
Exactly.
Yeah. And how is that's recalculated every year based on how many students you have?
Let me see if I can bring up some information here.
Yep, that's what I'm
looking at. This is a breakdown of our district where the taxes are coming from, the share of district population, the share of district enrollment. In fact, it's not distributed this way, but if you took the cost of the referendum package, you can see the contribution here. The key we have to show here to the entire district is that if we increase enrollment, that ratio of 52% being outside of La Crosse County, that's not going to change. So we have to show that there's an impact regionally, even though the facilities that are affected are going to be here in the city of La Crosse.
While we're on this question of distribution of the tax share and so forth, will you just describe briefly, please, what has to happen on November 6th for the referendum to pass?
Well, there will be an issue on the ballot. It'll be second following the school district referendum in this part of La Crosse County. And we'll be asking the authority to borrow $79.8 million for these facilities improvements in La Crosse, to the La Crosse campus for Western Technical College. And it'll be an up-and-down vote. The total vote for the district will determine if this is a successful referendum or not. In 1992, we did bring a referendum forward. It was to do facilities expansion here and also to do improvements in our satellite facilities. And it did pass. It passed by about a 60-40 margin. It was very encouraging for us because it passed in every major county. And if the counties don't feel they're getting a return on this, then this is not likely to be successful. So we don't know that that's going to happen now because this is a large issue and this is a very different time. But But that's why we're bringing it forward in a presidential election. Because we feel this is what we should do. We should bring our case forward and let the community weigh in by voting on November 6th.
So it will need to pass by a majority of voters
in all of those counties and
the totality of the district's population. Okay.
Yeah.
Any other questions from supervisors? If not, Supervisor Landry.
Sorry, just one more. Thank you. As you've, I'm sure, been making this case to other groups and other individuals, are there any recurring concerns you hear from them that you would like to explain or answer to us? I mean, so that if we have any lingering thoughts, if they're common or not, that you could answer that before we go?
Well, by far the largest issue that people raise has to do with an increase in taxes. And at this time, there are many people that feel that we're already overtaxed, and that's an issue they're bringing forward. When we have a chance to explain what the return on this investment is and to show that there's an impact on the regional economy that's very likely to follow with this, so that the return on that investment is there, we've had some very encouraging responses. And so I feel that if we get this message out in totality, we have a good chance for community support. But we'll see. I mean, this is a different time than 1992. And so that's something we're going to find out.
Thank you, Lee, very much for the presentation.
Thank you.
We appreciate it.
Thank you for this opportunity. Thank you.
Steve, are you going to introduce our next?
Next, we have a follow-up on drug court treatment. Dr. Bill Zolweg is going to provide a report on his research regarding 10-year recidivism history from our drug court. So, Dr. Bill Zolweg.
All right. Here we are. I was the original federal evaluator for the La Crosse Drug Court Program. I presented to this county board after the 3-year period of the initial startup of the drug court program. And I just want to say this, that this research that you're going to see today was not funded by the county. Instead, I applied for a small grant from the university, and I was assigned a research assistant, Alicia Braun, who did a lot of the legwork and frankly, a lot of the brain work that went into this report. Since we had a very, very small budget, we went to the Drug Court Executive Committee and asked them specifically what specific thing would you like us to look at with the program, and they said recidivism would be the main thing, and you know, obviously with any kind of criminal justice program, recidivism is the cornerstone of what you're trying to accomplish. And so let's see if I can work this thing. So what you see here in this chart is that the first drug court session was in 2002. At the time of this research, which was last spring, we finished this in May, there were about 20 participants. Those participants were not included in this research because they haven't graduated yet, so they really don't even have an opportunity to be counted as recidivists in terms of the definition. What you've had then is about 117 participants who have graduated over the 10-year period. Of those, 62% are males and 38% are females. And that's roughly comparable to the male-female ratio that's enrolled in the program that are participants in the program to begin with. This chart here shows the participants, the graduations, and the expulsions, and what you see is 50 graduates over that 10-year period amounts to a 43% graduation rate. The drug court is successful in getting five people a year, roughly, through the program. The program, though, the average amount of time that they spend in the program is about 18 months, so it's about a year and a half to make it through the drug court program because they require 12 months sobriety. And so since there are relapses in addiction recoveries, people get set back and then have to try and move forward from that point. And so it ends up taking about 18 months on average. 57% of the participants in the drug court program don't make it through the program. There are too many requirements. There are too many restrictions. It's just too arduous for them to be able to succeed in the program. I will have more to say on that in just a few minutes when I get to the next or a few charts down the road here. Here you see the of the 50 participants that have graduated from the program, 66% of the graduates are male, and that represents about 33 people. And 33% of the graduates were female. That's about 17 females. And that ratio is similar to what is enrolled in the program. So that's kind of what we would expect to see in terms of graduations. If you look at the expulsion side of the chart, the second three columns, you'll see that 60% of those expelled are male and 40% are female. But what's interesting here is that over the course of 10 years, the drug court has had 44 female participants and 27 have been expelled, which means there's a 61% expulsion rate for females compared to a 55% expulsion rate for males. And that might seem like maybe there's some sexism involved in the drug court program, but the truth of the matter is that people get addicted to drugs for lots of different reasons. For males, it's usually the allure of the drug itself. But for females, drugs are a means to a different end. And so females usually come into treatment programs with lots of other things going on in their life that they need treatment for besides just the drug addiction. And what we lack in the La Crosse area are programs that are dedicated to these other kinds of issues that aren't necessarily first and foremost drug related. So we don't have all of the kinds of resources at hand to treat the other issues that are going on in people's lives that will help them stay clean and sober for the rest of their life. In fact, if you just look at treatment programs in general, it's only been about 15 years that treatment programs really even started accepting women in drug treatment programs. Now, we've had the Betty Ford Clinic for alcoholism for quite some time, but that was really the first program for alcoholism that was devoted towards really dealing with women's issues in alcohol addiction. Now, since then, programs have really started trying to make programming that are specifically designed for women. But as I say, there's really it's a two different issue kind of problem when you're dealing with women and addiction compared to men and addiction. If you look at the graduation rates by age, the main thing here is that the older participants are more likely to graduate, and that is especially true for males. I think older addicts that are older, they reach a point where they get tired of the problems that are associated with their addiction. There isn't very much difference in age for the females. So between graduates and those that are expelled, the age difference is very similar, but you got about a 7-year difference for males. And that 7 years of being longer in the addiction cycle makes them a little bit more willing to make the changes that are needed to straighten up and live a sober life. Younger participants, though, are more likely to be expelled than older participants. And again, younger participants are probably much more likely to say, I don't really have a problem other than the law. And so they're not willing then to make the kind of lifestyle changes that are required to live a clean and sober life. Older participants are more likely to say, maybe I've got more of a problem than just the law, and are more willing to make those changes. This chart shows the LSI scores. The LSI is a measurement that the drug court team does to determine the eligibility or part of the eligibility for whether or not they're good candidates for the drug court. And what we look for is, at the national level, a higher LSI score. That means that they need lots of services. They're going to need lots of help to make it. And again, our problem in La Crosse, as you can see from the LSI scores, the higher scores are more likely to be expelled, the lower scores are more likely to graduate, and our problem in the La Crosse area is finding the resources and treatment facilities that are required for those people who demand higher levels of service. And we just don't have enough in the area for the higher level needs people. Now, that's not to say that we don't service a lot of higher level needs. The drug court program services people that have very high LSI scores. What happens, though, is you're lucky enough to find a really good match for treatment with an individual, and that person can make it through. If you're not lucky enough to find that and someone has to wait a while, or you have to try two or three different treatment modalities, then it's less likely that that person is going to be able to make it through the program. And here we get to the real fun part of it. And recidivism is a term that really doesn't have a stable definition. Every time you hear about a recidivism rate, believe me, there's a different definition being applied. The common definition, the definition that I like best, is that it's a person who, upon release from their penalty, commits the same level crime or a higher level crime. That's, I think, in the literature, the most standard definition for what recidivism means. So, for example, if somebody is arrested for robbery and they spend 10 years in prison, and then once released from prison, they get a ticket for drunk driving, that would not be considered a recidivist. He has not gone back to the same level of crime. He's committed actually a lower level crime than robbery, and so that would not be counted. This definition shows that the drug court over 10 years now has a recidivism rate of 20%. The national average for drug court recidivism is 20 to 30%. And recidivism rates for drug addicted offenders that just go to jail or prison is 85%. This definition is not the definition that the Drug Court Executive Committee wanted me to use, but the next chart shows something that they did want me to look at, and that is there's a very common belief on the drug court team that even the people who are expelled from drug court get a great deal of value from the participation they've had in the program. And so they wanted me to look at what's the recidivism rate for people who get expelled from the program. And this is, I looked at this regardless of the amount of time that they're in the program. So they could be in the program 3 months, or they could be in the program 12 months or even 18 months. And this shows that we do very well with this. We've expelled 10 males and 9 females. And their recidivism rate is 28%. So clearly, but you know, we're using a high or actually a low bar for recidivism, where I say they have to commit the same level crime or higher. So 28% is still very, very good, especially when you look at what we do with drug-addicted offenders that just go to prison. Now, here's where the Drug Court Executive Committee, they want me to use recidivism as a misdemeanor offense or higher. So here you have somebody who maybe has a felony drug conviction, and now we're going to say they're a recidivist if they get arrested for disorderly conduct. So I agree. We'll use that definition. Let's see what it looks like. I expected it to be actually through the roof, probably 65-75%. Instead, it's 36%. So it's still phenomenal. Even the recidivism rate, even for those who are expelled from the program, is still better than what you get through traditional judicial sentences. And if we look at expulsions, this is the misdemeanor. It's 48% with the misdemeanor rate. Using that low bar or the high bar. Yeah.
Do you have a national comparison for that also?
Pardon?
Do you have a national comparison also for that?
No, I don't. No one's ever looked at expelled drug court participants. So I don't have that.
Do you want to take questions now or do you want to wait till the end? Your call.
That's the end right here.
Oh, perfect timing. Supervisor Veenstra has a question then.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So do you mind going back to one slide back?
Oh,
or can we
let's
do that?
Let's see. Okay. Thank you.
Under the STARD, 36% of those who graduate from the program are eventually rearrested for a crime.
Right.
Is it actual convictions or just arrests?
Just arrests.
Okay.
Yes. Just arrest.
Supervisor Weers.
Can you tell us briefly or as quickly as possible, I guess, what the expulsion considerations are? Is that, are you expelled only for a drug relapse, or can you be expelled,
no.
like, for
in
example,
fact, in
for...
In fact, you are not expelled for a drug relapse.
Okay.
You know, I mean, with any kind of treatment for a drug addiction, there is... And, of course, no one tells participants this. But it's very, very difficult, almost impossible, to stop cold turkey and never have a relapse. So in drug courts, we try to train the drug court teams in a way that says we have to figure out how to use the relapse as something positive. And if you've ever been to a drug court meeting where someone has relapsed, you'll see the judge works very hard to figure out how to make this a learning experience, something positive, something to figure out what will you do next time that will be different than what you did this time. Now, that didn't address your question, so let me get to your question. You can be expelled for noncompliance. You know, there are so many things that a drug court participant is required to do. They have to make all these meetings. They have to go in for drug testing, you know, sometimes two or three times a day. And if they miss those, if they don't make their meetings, if they're not really complying with their treatment requirements, those are the kinds of things that you generally get expelled for. Because if you're not gonna do this and we punish you the first time you don't do it, so they might have to spend a weekend in jail, or they might have to write an essay or sit in what we call in lacrosse the penalty box for the rest of the day. If those things don't have the desired effect to get you to change your behavior, then the drug court team kind of runs out of options as to how we can help the individual.
Well, that was my specific concern, was the slide where you pointed out that the females had a much higher rate of being expelled.
Yes.
Proportionally. And I wonder if that has something to do with finding the difficulty in finding childcare for if expulsion comes from this making meetings and coming in three or four times a day or that or whatever. Is there something where they get help, you know, for that child care?
Yes, and the drug court team is very conscious of those kinds of difficulties, and I doubt that that would be a reason for anyone to be expelled.
You see that difference, or that unproportional difference of females versus males being more those other things that they're dealing with?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Supervisor Burns.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Dr. Zolwick, for that really compelling presentation. The two things that I found really compelling with your information, first, that there's value in the program even if individuals are expelled. And the second is older people are more successful than younger people in the program. So I guess my questions are this. Is there any way that we can get, number one, more older people in the program? And number two, is there any way, I know that, you know, somebody's expelled, and I guess my question, I have two more questions. The first part of my second question is, if you get expelled, is that expulsion kind of like a lifetime expulsion where they're never ever allowed back into the program? Or is there some kind of cooling off period where they can kind of gather their thoughts and think about what just happened, and maybe six months or a year from now, they can go back into the program? Because it sounds like there's a lot of value in the program. My question is, are people given a second chance in the program, or one time and they're out?
More than a second chance. But let me get to your first question first. And you know, the drug court doesn't recruit. So it's a referral-based program, but anyone can refer someone, but there are eligibility requirements. Mm-hmm. And one of them is that you have to be assessed as being addicted to the drug. Now, you don't have to be arrested necessarily for a drug offense. So you could be, you know, a burglar, for example, and if the defense attorney says, well, holy smokes, I mean, he's robbing or she's robbing houses because they're an addict. The defense attorney can refer that person to the drug court team, and then they go through the regular assessment program. They're brought to the drug court to see what the requirements are and how much it's going to affect your life. Then they're asked if they want to be in the program or not. And then the drug court team assesses all of the information they have about the individual and makes a recommendation to the judge. Your second one and the third one, if you could just remind me of those again.
So, you know, if somebody gets expelled, is that expulsion?
Yes.
Can there be a cooling off period where they enter back into the program?
It's a long process to get expelled. I don't really think there are any members on the La Crosse Drug Court team who want to expel people. So you're told, you know, as a participant that, you know, we're going to give you another try. And here's what you have to do to become compliant with the program. And then they're told again that this is our last time. And then they have an expulsion hearing where they actually appear before the drug court team with their attorney, and they get asked questions about whether or not they can make it because they're trying to stay in. They, you know, obviously they recognize that being clean is a big benefit. And it's only after that. I would say there's probably a minimum of three shots at it. But the real point is La Crosse does not have a re-entry program.
Okay, that was my question, and it sounds like maybe a re-entry program would have value in La Crosse County.
Yes, I would say that a reentry program is valuable.
Because even like you said, not everyone's going to make it the first time, even after you give them three or four chances. But, you know, maybe after they're maybe either in jail or something else happens in their life and they say, well, 6 months or a year from now, they're like, I probably should go, maybe I should have, they start to rethink, oh, maybe I can do it differently next time. And that's interesting. And then I have another follow-up question after that response is, how many people are turned down each year for drug court that want to be in but can't be in? And then how can we get more people in the program? I know there's lack of financial resources, but I'm just curious.
How many people are turned down?
I just looked at my notes. I don't have that number.
Okay. The ones that are turned down are, you know, I can't speak to the number either. But the ones that are turned down, you know, are probably they don't meet the eligibility criteria. So, you see, the drug court program isn't really designed for people that are habitual users. You know, we really need an addict. You need to be that addicted. And so if you're a user, then, you know, it's not good for anybody, because here's what happens. If I'm a user and you bring me into the drug court, I'll quit. I'm going to sail through this program in 12 months, and then guess what? 2 weeks from now, he's going to arrest me for using. Because, you know, I just stopped for a while. I can do that. Addicts can't do that. So, you know, they might be able to figure out, I can beat this drug test by, drinking a gallon of water before I come in and give my urine to the tester. But they won't be able to do that for a very long period of time. So they're going to get caught.
Thank you. Thank you.
Supervisor Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Bill, you've talked a lot about expel and all, but can you hit a little bit on, you've also used another term, graduation. Can you just hit on some of the points that they go through to graduate? And I know there's a lot of them, but you...
Yeah, well, I can go through some of them. You know, they have to, first of all, be signed up for a treatment program. They have to also not, and this is a formal treatment program, outpatient treatment, inpatient treatment, whatever the assessment requires that they do. And they also have to do some voluntary support. They have to be involved in a voluntary support group. Now, typically the voluntary support group in the La Crosse area is AA meetings or NA meetings. And they have to make those meetings, and that's checked by the drug court team. They have to pay all of the child support. They have to pay all of their fines. They have to have a job. All of these things are, you know, just really some of the basic requirements. But, you know, they're overwhelmed in the program is a three-phase program. They're overwhelmed in phase one because, you know, they leave that first day and they've got a list of 15 different things they have to do the next day. And, you know, they got to get up at 8 o'clock in the morning and they got to be here. And the drug court team accepts no excuses. So you can't go in and say, well, I would have made that meeting, but my car broke down. No, you that doesn't work. There's no excuse. You have to be there. If you're not there, then you're subject to the negative sanctions that the drug court team issues to you. So all told, they have to have 12 total months of total sobriety. No alcohol, no drugs, no nothing. And they can't miss meetings. They can't miss any of the requirements that the drug court team puts on them. So it's very hard, especially for people who aren't used to doing anything.
Okay. Thank you.
Supervisor Berg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Zolwig, what happens to those people who are expelled from the program?
Great question. They go back to their sentencing, their original sentencing judge, and they're sentenced according to whatever crime it was they committed before they became drug court participants. So now, you know, the unfortunate part of that is that, you know, we do pretty well for a lot of those people, but most of those people are going to be back and doing the same thing over again. And, you know, one of the frustrating things for me as a criminologist is you never hear anybody say, even though I can point to that 85% recidivism, you never hear anybody say, prison's a total failure, we should just shut it down.
Is that it for you, Supervisor Morgan? Supervisor Veenstra.
For drug addicts, prison is a total failure, and we should shut it down. Anyway, I was kind of curious about the couple of factors that you pointed out earlier with regard to age and LSI score with regard to expelled participants. Yeah. Did those correlate as they did for graduated participants?
I'm not sure I understand. You mean the graduates and the expelled?
Correct.
Yes, those are the same. Or similar.
Okay. And I guess I've had people participate in this as a defense lawyer, and the way I would describe it to people in the room is a scholarship that you hope your friends and family never get to be in the drug court. Yeah. It's a benefit. It's a big benefit. You might be looking at 10 years in prison, but instead you get to have a year and a half to 2 years of hard labor in the drug court.
Right. Yep. And our hope is that if you make it through the program, you can live a life that's a productive citizen. As Judge Perlich used to say when he started this program, we like to turn these people from tax suckers into taxpayers.
Supervisor Friedland.
Thank you, Dr. Zolwig. I'm interested in what you said about La Crosse not having the support for some of the people coming out. What do you mean by that? Do you mean like employers with programs to hire ex-offenders?
Yes.
Or
keep going.
Housing, available housing, halfway type housing to keep people.
Yes, to treatment programs, to programs for specific kinds of treatment. For example, treatment for spousal abuse or partner abuse or child abuse or sexual assault.
That's interesting. Even with all the services that La Crosse has for people who are here and people come in, there are still gaps.
Right. And, you know, it's not that we don't have services, because La Crosse is better than most places at having services. We have services that are available. We don't have services that are targeted. And so what you end up with then is, if I'm lucky, I get someone who knows my issue and can really help me.
Supervisor Laundrie.
Thank you. I guess after listening to your presentation, I'm mostly surprised by what seemed like a low number of participants overall.
Yeah.
Because based on sort of the prevalence of the drug problem in our community, I'm really quite shocked at how low the participation rate is.
Yes.
Is there some barrier that we need as a community or as elected officials we need to get through in order to make sure that we get more people into a successful program like this? Is it purely financial? If you can explain why that number seems very low to me.
Well, you know, 20 participants in a drug court program, you know, and it's a drug court team, so you're asking the prosecutor to cut out time. You're asking defense bar to make time. You're asking treatment staff to leave their treatment facility and come to the court. You're asking probation and parole to send someone over. Am I leaving someone out? You have a caseworker and the judge who has to take time away to sit in a room and talk about these 20 people and what they've done this week. You know, it's a very long meeting, And, you know, I can tell you from sitting in on a few of them, they don't always agree. And the way they disagree, to me, I, as a criminologist, I find one of the most fascinating aspects of drug courts. Frequently, and I, you know, I don't have any numbers for this, but I can just tell you, very frequently, you'll hear the defense bar arguing to this person needs a weekend in jail, and you'll hear the prosecutor arguing, no, I don't really think jail is going to do any good. So it's like the roles aren't always strict as what you would expect them to be coming into this kind of a meeting. And then, of course, the drug court, the court session itself is a pretty long affair, too. Although I think Judge Pacelle has done, and the drug court team has done, a really good job of streamlining it down to deal with the number of participants they have. So, you know, we have one judge, and so it's, I'm not sure. I wish I had a really, I wish I could just say it was, you know, we need more money, you know.
But the red piece came off. I don't know. I was just really excited that to ask that first question. My follow-up question, I guess, is then if it's sort of not feasible to rehabilitate addicts, I guess if that's the right terminology to use, solely through a drug court program, is there a direction that we need to go, again, as elected officials or as a community, to try to come up with? I mean, it doesn't seem like we're not doing something right.
Well, you know, I think what the community does in our treatment programs that are available in the community are designed, for the most part, for voluntary treatment, and I think they do a splendid job with those people. People who have said, you know, I've lost my job, my wife might be leaving me, and I'm not going to get visitation with my kids. I've got to straighten up here. And so our programs in La Crosse do a great job. The drug court program is really a coerced treatment. We don't really care if you want to be there. In fact, we just figure you don't want to be there. And what we hope is that we can keep you clean and sober to the point where your brain starts to function normally again. And then it becomes really voluntary. And, you know, as a drug court participant on the drug court teams, you can almost see people making that change to where it goes from, I don't want to be here, to, you know, this is not so bad, to, gosh, I'm really thrilled that I got to be involved in this program. You can really kind of see it, them making the change. And one of the things that the drug court team looks for is, you know, you have an opportunity when you go in for testing to have your urine sampled. You have the opportunity of stopping them right there and say, there's no need to test. I'm dirty. I used. And they won't usually do that when they're new into the program. They'll usually go, no, you know, I was cleaning some car parts with alcohol and it must have soaked through my skin. Or no, I didn't smoke the pot. I was just in a car with a bunch of people and they were smoking pot. I swear I didn't. You know, they'll do all of those kinds of things where they try to. And of course, none of that, Matt. We don't really care why you test positive. The positive test is a positive test, and you get the same sanction or not. But if you come to the judge and the judge asks you, and this is the way he starts every participant off, how were your tests today? And if you say they were dirty, judge, then the judge says, you know, you just told me the truth. And that's really a step up in your recovery from lying and deceit and manipulation. And it's really considered kind of a positive thing that you're now actually being honest with people. And it's a start that you can do that with the judge, because already, you know you're going to get caught, so you might as well be honest. But that's a small step, and it's a sign that they're going to start being honest with themselves.
Supervisor Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Dr. Zollweg. The mention of scholarship made me wonder, what is the comparative cost of having someone go through drug treatment court as opposed to shipping them off to jail or prison or whatever? I'm assuming you're saving money, right?
It does. It varies around the country, and so you get kind of two different ones based on how much your particular jail or your prison system costs. But the two different figures that are floated around nationally are it's 10 to 1 or 10 to 2. So, you know, it costs $10 to send them to prison, whereas you'd spend $1 on them in a drug court. Just to give you an example, for the state of Wisconsin, our current 1 year in prison in the state of Wisconsin, depending upon the prison you go, between $35,000 and $40,000 a year of treatment in La Crosse County is about $2,000.
So we really do
want to. Well, then you got to have a way of taking them in.
Dr. Zollweg, thank you very much for a wonderful presentation. Oh, Supervisor Geary.
Well, just as a response to that question, I think the reason they went to prison, it wasn't because they were a habitual drug user, because they could continually commit crimes, and someone may be more violent or more whatever to support their habit. So at some point in time, society is going to have to incarcerate some of these people.
I agree, but in the La Crosse drug program, violent offenders are automatically ineligible. So they're gone.
Okay, but you don't know they're violent until they get arrested and convicted of a violent crime. You'll have them in your statistics until something would change. My other question was, the sample size seems small. I mean, just...
It's not a sample.
Dr. Zollweg, can you...
My thing is, if you'd have three or four success stories versus three or four failures, it would skew the numbers. You know, the percentages would go up or down, whatever... If you graduate and leave the area, how do you track them, or do you take them out of the sample, or what do you do?
No, we did the search was done nationally and across state board.
Supervisor Geary, if you're still asking a question, will you use your mic, please?
It's that if you leave La Crosse and move to New York,
do we
still track them?
That's right.
Oh, by Social Security number or
no, national tracking systems.
Dr. Zollweg, if you're up for one more question,
sure.
Please. Supervisor Ebert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I'm real interested in the recidivism and comparing it so that in La Crosse County we get a common definition so that we can compare programs, various programs we do. On yours, is it over 3 years or is it for 10 years?
10 years.
Okay, so yours was a full 10 years.
Yes.
Okay, thank you very much, sir.
Yep, and as far as I know, this is the first piece of research on drug court that's been 10 years out. Normally, when you see things that report recidivism rates, it's three years.
And that would be, it's normally the 3 years with any crime.
Any crime, right. Okay. And if you look at recidivism rates for prison, it's 3 years after you're released.
Thank you, sir.
Right, they don't go 10 years. So these people have had ample opportunity. So it's not a sample. This is total. It's 50. It's all of them.
Thank you.
Every one of them. And the national search was done by the prosecutor and by the judges. So they literally tracked down every name.
Thank you again very much, Dr. Zollweg. We appreciate it. We have one more item for you, Mr. O'Malley.
To show you the breadth of issues and ideas we deal with at the county government, we're moving on to farmland preservation. This was an attempt to give you a little bit more time to weigh in than just next Thursday when you'll be considering the farmland preservation ordinance. Mr. Handy wasn't here at the last meeting when it was introduced for first reading, so we wanted to make sure that you had a bit of time to ask him as the lead staff person on this. There were maps earlier that are here. I'm sure Charlie, having stuck around this long, will be available after the meeting if you had a particular question on a map. Mr. Handy.
Okay. We basically finished drafting the farmland preservation plan in August and September of last year, 2011. We submitted it for certification to DATCAP, and we received a letter from DATCAP that it was approved for certification pending your approval. This letter for certification is dated March 5th of 2012. The draft of the farmland preservation plan and now codified as ordinance has been on the website since that March letter as is. It was there before that since August in the form where we made minor revisions to a couple places in the text based on comments from DATCAP. So 95% of it has been on the website since September of 2011. The maps that are back there, there's also maps on the backside of the of those boards. Those are all on the website, on the document on the website. And if you have any questions, if you want to see them larger, or if you want to see larger sections of the maps that are more correlative to your demographic area, I can certainly blow them up and send it to you. I can send you things electronically. I would say that as a staff, as a Farmland Preservation Committee, we're very proud of this document. One of the things you'll see is the document that was adopted in 1980. Just looking at it, and maybe I can drop it on the floor and you can listen to it, and then looking at the document here. 49 pages is a lot of pages, but it's not a lot when you compare it to 250. We did a real nice job of keeping it from getting too verbose. It's fairly simple, but I would also say that it is very indicative. If you look at the map, everybody can look right at the top of Jeff's head, the map with the green. The areas that are in the green color are areas that are eligible for farmland preservation tax credits. There are 300,000 plus, 308,000 roughly acres in La Crosse County. There's more than 230,000 acres that are eligible for farmland preservation. We are not as urban as we all sometimes think. And so I think that's a very good map. It's very indicative. It also shows you that T-style pattern of development that we have in La Crosse County following the interstate and La Crosse River, and then following Highway 53, 157, and the Mississippi and Black Rivers. Obviously, that's where the development has occurred over the years historically and where it continues to occur. So the Farmland Preservation Plan matches our comprehensive plan. All of the municipalities that have comprehensive plans have had an effect on the Farmland Preservation Plan. We met and had a public informational meeting at all of the municipalities in La Crosse County. So I was at 17 municipalities between June and September of 2011 to talk with the residents of all of those municipalities about the Farmland Preservation Plan. I believe in those 17 public informational meetings, I met with 8 people. So unfortunately, the participation rate wasn't as what we would have liked, but I think we were able to use the public participation that we got through the comprehensive planning process and through the stakeholders that we talked to, through the public officials that we talked to get enough information to make this a good plan. Literally? No. DATCAP is the Wisconsin Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection. They manage Chapter 91 of the Wisconsin statutes, which regulates how a farmland preservation plan needs to be drafted and codified and then certified by the state. If we are not certified as a farmland preservation plan, and then if our new zoning ordinance is not certified as a farmland preservation zoning ordinance, then our landowners do not qualify for farmland preservation tax credits. And to give you a little bit of an idea of the significance of the tax credits, they are $7.50 per acre. So if you have 1,000 acres, just do the math, that's per year. So it's a pretty significant investment in the state in farmland preservation, in us as taxpayers, And so doing this plan is important to use those taxpayer dollars wisely. We don't want to issue farmland preservation tax credits in the city of La Crosse, which we were doing up until this plan was drafted. It's a much better way to be frugal with those dollars to understand from our comprehensive planning efforts, this is where we should invest our farmland preservation dollars.
Supervisor Paff.
Thank you. You said the number of acres in La Crosse County that are eligible. How many of those eligible acres are actually enrolled?
I have no idea. We're not allowed to know that because of a privacy issue between the Department of Revenue and the landowner.
Right. And see, to qualify for these, there is different things. I am in farmland preservation and going through the, have been since, I believe it was introduced in 78, wasn't it?
Ours was adopted in 1980, so probably 78 right, sounds right.
Because the townships were available and they were described as exclusive ag. They had to make that decision in order to do it, and some didn't. But anyway, what I was getting at is the reason that when you show that you could get tax relief of $7.50 per acre, that is the maximum, and it's also based on your income.
No, that well, formula has changed.
That formula...
There's no income basis anymore. It's $7.50 an acre straight.
That is the new rules then.
Mm-hmm.
Because you see, before it was up to 10%
yep.
of your tax bill is what you was eligible for on your eligible acres, excluding your residence. But now at this time, you say it's going to be straight through $7.50.
It has been since 2009, and we've seen significant underreporting in La Crosse County. The tax preparers, the professional accountants, et cetera, that are preparing that form for the income taxes for the state haven't been trained well enough to understand that it's just straight $7.50 an acre. So we're working on that. That's an education process.
And when you made the comment that residents in La Crosse, city proper, is that what you meant? Or did you
that they're not eligible for farmland preservation
well,
tax
that
credits?
That they had been?
Yeah, there were landowners in the city of La Crosse within the boundaries of the city of La Crosse that were eligible prior to drafting this plan.
Because they were the owner of land, eligible land outside of the city.
No. Inside the city limits. That's why we
like
did this
to
plan.
See that. Okay. No more questions. I have to see how that could possibly be.
Other questions or comments? Supervisor Weirs.
I just wanted to point out to Mr. Paff that according to Greg Stengel, 241 participants were in the program before that rule was put in where we couldn't know that information. And what year was that? Wasn't that long ago, right?
99.
Yeah, it was kind of long ago. But anyway,
that's not that long ago.
Some people maybe didn't know if it was like 10 people or 1,000 people, so right. I just thought we would
yeah.
throw that.
241. Yeah, we're assuming it's somewhere between 200 and 250.
Other questions or comments? Remember that this is, you know, we are providing this time and having Charlie here, knowing that second reading is coming next Thursday at the regular board meeting. So, Supervisor Gamroth.
Thank you. Charlie, I talked to you this morning about this. Did the constituents in my district that you had spoken to, did they understand this? I wasn't able to make the meeting thoroughly as far as if there are no changes, as you told me this morning, it's the same as it's been. Did they understand that?
I don't know which
when
constituents
I asked you this,
you're
well,
referring
whether
to.
It be
when I was at the public informational meeting
right,
there,
right.
Nobody showed up. So it's hard to know if they understood
nobody,
or not.
Nobody.
Oh. Sometimes it's easier to understand when you don't.
Well, that's true.
Kind of meeting. Not always.
So.
But.
There was
but just the town boards were there, and that was...
We've met with the town's unit a couple of times, and we talked with the town boards about this issue. That public information meeting specifically in the town of Burns was not attended.
And town of Bangor?
Two.
Was it clear to them that this is nothing new? I mean,
yeah, so yes. Everybody that I've talked to understands the program, and they understand, you know, what the conservation compliance requirements are and things like that.
Okay, thank you.
Supervisor Landry, who has no farmland preservation eligible land in his district?
Not that I know of. Actually, do you know of any examples of what that would have been within the city of La Crosse? Where
sure, there's quite a bit of land that is not tillable, that is swampland, wetland, steep slopes, things like that. Obviously, you know, timber harvesting is a farm commodity. And so, you know, there was some legitimate reasons for some of these areas getting farmland preservation tax credit. But looking at the comprehensive plans, if they're slotted for development or if they're slotted for preservation, okay, they're being preserved. Why should we continue to give them tax credits to be preserved? We're just trying to be frugal with those dollars and make them stretch.
Okay, and that wasn't my question. My question actually was, do you think that was a follow-up to your comment? Do you think that there's going to be, I guess we won't know because we can't, I guess, but do you think there's going to be an increased participation if it's been simplified, you know, to $750 per acre, as opposed to something that sounds like it was much more complex? And
if you want my professional opinion, which I have a lot of those, my answer is, in today's culture, no, because there's an awful lot of people out there that are very, very wary of the government and any type of government programs. Now, maybe if the culture changes in a few years, $7.50 an acre is quite a bit of money, and if they realize that they have to comply with these conservation standards anyway by state statute, that may go up. It's just, first and foremost, a very independent crowd, a very independent demographic, and they're very easily influenced by a lot of the scary stories that are out there about government.
Any other questions or comments on farmland preservation? Supervisor Schrader.
What would be the process of requesting a public hearing?
Asking for it? I mean, any supervisor can ask for a public hearing.
Right. We've already held a public hearing. We held a public hearing in October of 2011. If you want another one, that's fine.
But the answer to your question is any supervisor can ask for a public hearing.
But that you held those public hearings at individual places, right? It wasn't
well,
county-wide.
The individual ones were public informational meetings. We held a public hearing in the what's the room down the hall?
B1.
The auditorium for the farmland preservation plan. That was a public hearing.
What were the results of that? How many people showed up for that?
Well, there was about 75 people in the room. About 3 people talked.
Okay, remember this will be on the agenda for second reading next Thursday. So, Mr. O'Malley, is that it for you? Any suggestions for future agenda items? Just a reminder, if you haven't already, to fill out your United Way pledge form. It can be turned and take the pink copy off of the back, and you can return the top 2 copies to Ginny, please, at the front when you've completed it. Supervisor Ebert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Also, Jenny might want to give a reminder about that every 2 months to turn in your expense thing, not waiting for longer. Since that's kind of a change, that might be a good thing as a reminder to us all.
So do you want us to remind you every month or every other month?
Well, I think we really only
we reminded last month, but we can remind every month. That's fine.
I must not have been here.
So thank you, Supervisor Ebert, for raising this issue that we're asking for expense reports to be submitted within 60 days of incurring an expense, please. Any other future agenda items? If not, Supervisor Richmond.
I move to adjourn. Thank you.
Moved by Supervisor Richmond, seconded by Supervisor Friedland. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Opposed, no. We are adjourned.